This podcast is brought to you by Indian Health Service, Division of Diabetes Treatment and Prevention, leading the effort to treat and prevent diabetes in American Indians and Alaskan Natives.
Good morning, relatives, and my apologies for my time mishap this morning. I want to acknowledge the traditional owners of this land, this beautiful state of New Mexico. Just saw on the slide there are many of our attendees are from the state, and I thank you for allowing us to be on your land today. I thought we'd talk about core stuff, roots. And this looks like a lot of roots here. But just to give, my talk is really to give some examples about what's happening just in one region, which is where I currently am in the Pacific Northwest, for how certain concepts of traditional medicine are being used within communities, and to give just some food for thought about what we as healthcare professionals can do to support community efforts in this regard. There's the objectives. So the first one, I know for some of you who have heard other talks here before, we've gone over certain elements related to traditional medicine, but I was asked to go over that very briefly first. But I'd like to spend the bulk of the time focusing on a little bit, again, of a potpourri of different programs that I've been involved with or have been aware of that are happening in our area that I think will illustrate some of these points. Many of you are familiar with the definition of traditional medicine worldwide as defined by the World Health Organization. And I think that one of the important concepts here and something that I see in teaching interns and residents and medical students is that for some, especially some of my non-Indigenous colleagues, some of them struggle with the issues of how do we know that, you know, kind of going back to the scientific method about whether it's explicable in terms of Western logic. And I think the WHO statement really is very clear that that there is indigenous logic as well as Western logic, and those two things are not always mutually opposed, and that that our traditional systems are used to be able to treat, you know, certainly mind-body issues along the spectrum of prevention to treatment. If we were to change this a bit and think about it from what is native medicine here, perhaps in North America, I would still use those same concepts in terms of wellness, prevention, and illness or diagnostic care, but with the goal being certainly holistic balance, particularly issues involving emotions and spirit. I think many of us are pretty well versed in terms of Western training for issues of dealing with physical issues and issues that may be related to certain mental health pieces. But the part that I think is a bit different, certainly as a family physician, and again, teaching some of this, is how do we really promote the work that's really being done in community, and what is the connection with traditional medicine with the natural world? Because again, we work so much with the one-on-one, except for those of you perhaps who work in public health concepts. But I think that from my perspective, just, you know, in this area, it has a lot more to do just with individuals, the broader family, the broader community, and the broader world, and melded in with our culture, which was very beautifully illustrated in the talks this morning. Certainly, components vary by tribe and region, and yet I think that there may be some similarities between, you know, within our regions in terms of thinking of our whether it's seasonal cycles, circle cycles of life, and issues of respect and honor, which again were well illustrated this morning. But I think we're also looking for an ultimate result of harmonious relationships, just, you know, restoring balance. You know why these practices are important. Many of you have been in our communities for quite some time, and so I think you see the value of this. But for those who may be new to the Indian health system, almost two decades ago, this has come up with a traditional cultural advocacy program that Dr. Trujillo was involved with when he was the director of IHS. And it's basically part of our mandate within the Indian health service system, whether you work in an urban setting or in a tribal entity, as being policy, but it's not for Indian Health Service to dictate what any community does with those particular concepts. In terms of what some of the elements are, which is our first objective, this is a hard thing to do justice to. And so again, forgive me, I know there are many elders in this room and people who have other experiences with this. to me, the, just as an indigenous person, the core issue to me is land. It's relationship to a place. I belong to a place. That place is Ganawage. That in Mohawk means the place of the rapids. It's the last set of rapids on the St. Lawrence River before that goes to the sea. And so that land is me. I am part of that land. There is relationship to that. There's also relationship to season in traditional medicine concepts in terms of certain things that can happen at certain times based on where we are in that cycle. A core concept relates to our language, our indigenous languages, and those are very much at risk in some of our communities. We hear this all the time, and with elders being really fearful about the next generation not being able to speak our languages. And traditional medicine has a lot to do with traditional food and also what we other things we put into our bodies, especially the health of our water, which is the first medicine. It may have to do with issues of other physical medicines, such as medicines that come from the animal world or the plant world. And we're not going to talk too much about the specifics of that today. It also has to do with spiritual practices. And those spiritual practices, again, have tremendous variation and may not be things that, that again, in the context of clinical settings that our patients are going to be necessarily forthcoming about until there's some relationship of trust with us. But some of those might include issues of fasting for a specific purpose or for certain health of the body. It may involve different forms of purification, whether that purification is sweat lodge or other purification ceremonies. It may involve the issue of offerings for a specific purpose to set intention for the work you're doing or for an endeavor, and certainly involves prayer, which most of you, again, are aware of. It involves our attitude. Traditional medicine has to do with sometimes reforming our attitude about what's important in life and how we can think about the challenges that we face. We've heard this morning some terrific stories and saw a beautiful digital story related to what's happening in the community that was shared. But storytelling is a really important piece of our medicine ways. Songs are may be involved, issues of specific dances, not necessarily social dances, but what I would call sacred dances. And clearly the issues of who are our healers in the communities, who are our counselors, who are the elders who help to support us, and certainly the issue of ceremony in all of its many forms, whether, again, that be small ceremony or whether it's being done on a community-wide basis. Though some of you may be familiar with a textbook that was written by Mim Dixon and Pam Iron, and if you haven't seen this from the American Public Health Association, especially those of you who are working to manage programs, this is a really excellent small book as well as its accompanying DVD. And they ask a really important question, which is, again, in the context of healthcare, how do we make any kind of time or give the important respect that's needed to acknowledge our culture within the context of healthcare and the context of the history that we heard our relatives speak of this morning, some of these very difficult things, but also some of our profound joy and resilience within our indigenous communities. I'd like to switch gears with you and take you to the lovely Pacific Northwest, which is raining, of course, right now, so I'm really appreciative of the sun. And share with you some examples about what some of our communities are doing related to their definition of traditional medicine. And within the context, I'd like to focus on these areas, with one of them being, again, just core relationship to land, which, again, as a family physician, is something I think about all the time, and maybe I think about that because I work with plants. But it has to do with what do we do with the safety of our place and the safety of our water. It has to. And I'd like to talk a bit about traditional foods and access to traditional foods because I think this also impacts our urban communities who are struggling mightily with this, not being able to be on their home territory. I'd like to talk a bit about access to traditional medicine specifically and about how our healers are acting as mentors to health professionals in certain situations. And then lastly, a little bit about a gathering that's going on that is a really terrific example of what I call intertribal healing. This quote is actually from a European physician from many centuries ago, who actually apparently has been considered to be the founder of modern chemistry. So I think it's really interesting that that he had a turnaround in terms of his view of molecules or whatever was known about molecules 400 years ago, to understanding that really the art of healing really comes from the natural world. I also think that that there are elders in our region in the Pacific Northwest who said that very eloquently as well, including Vi Hilbert, who some of you may have known from Upper Skagit, when she basically said in Lushootseed, the earth is our first teacher. And so this interdependence of health, again, not just the one-on-one with individuals, but it has to do with what is the health of where we live. And again, as an indigenous person, I have specific teachings related to that. And all of you in this room who are, you understand what I'm talking about, that all of our communities, I think, are teaching us that we have a place and we need to stay connected to that place somehow and to take care of that place. And I think this has a lot to do with what we're capable of doing in terms of reversing the impact of colonization, is to remember those original teachings. And this requires a variety of different approaches to be able to do that very thing. This is what I tell my students. We need to be out of our offices. medicine and health have a lot, have a lot to do with that. Some of you may recognize this place. This is in Washington State. This is Snoqualmie Falls. This is a sacred site for the tribe that I work for. And the reason I put this slide up is, again, in terms of returning to our roots, many of you, again, this is a very small community of less than 1,000 people. This is a community that was terminated back in the 50s when we were through the termination era for many of our tribes who the federal government saw fit to think that they didn't exist anymore. And so this is a community that less than a decade ago had its rights restored. And one of the places they went once that very special event happened to them to heal was this place, was back to Snoqualmie Falls. Some of you may not know, unless you have been here, that that right on top, what you cannot see in the river above, is that there is an electric plant that's there. And the tribe does not actually own that. It does not have jurisdiction over that part of its traditional territory, which is still a wound in their heart. Why is this important to me as a healthcare provider? Because I actually take care of the people of this community, some of whom are still fighting to be able to get that back. And I see the impact on their chronic disease. I see the impact on their emotional health. And every June, they gather together there, along with other peoples around the world, to pray for sacred sites. Now, this is an open invitation in our community verbally. It doesn't, nobody puts it out online. There's no newsletters, there's no engraved invitations. But the community is basically telling, asking those who feel like they need to be there, is like, be there with us. Do you see that this is important for our healing? And again, I'm surprised sometimes in terms of just the small numbers from other employees who are there for health. But to me, that's vital. I mean, that's part of what we're doing in our communities, is to support their work to get their land back and support the people who are doing the hard work. There are other tribes who are not as fortunate in terms of having that termination reversed, such as the Duwamish, which is the home territory of the city of Seattle. And so, again, as a native physician, I still feel it's important when those communities ask for help and ask for support that we need to show up and help them to get their land back. Land and water restoration is really big in our area. Again, even though it's wealthy in terms of rain in certain areas of our zone, we still have some trouble in terms of issues of water access and purity, and again, in terms of land land. The tribe that I work for, Snoqualmie, has a variety of different programs, one of which is just protecting the watershed. And some of it's pragmatic because they live in a floodplain. And so sometimes I can't get to clinic because the river is flooding, and that's a challenge. So what they have done is, again, to offer to the entire community, including the medical staff, opportunities to help them restore that watershed. which means getting out in the mud, because this happens rain or shine. These plants will not wait, and floods will not wait. So we do that. Some of us will go out and actually participate in that work in terms of putting in plants that are appropriate to that area. We also see this with other communities in our area. Our neighbor to the north, Swinomish, is actually working specifically on estuary management because they're interested in protecting that waterway to be able to keep their salmon coming home, because salmon is so vital to the life of the people and to the physical and spiritual health of the people. Our area has a couple of examples of tribal enterprises that actually help communities to do exactly that in terms of restoration, and Stillaguamish is one of them. What's interesting there is that they have gone through great effort to actually propagate certain traditional medicines, plants that are indigenous to our region that also have medicinal value. And again, communities who need access to those plants can actually, if they are unable to get them from other sources, this community has been able to provide them for the people. And that, this again, I love plants, so I always enjoy looking at a nice garden. But anyway, there's lots of resources available there. I've been very impressed with the work of Confederated Tribes of Wumatilla, who gave a terrific presentation less than a month ago in Seattle. And this community has a very broad way of looking at health in terms of just the whole ecology of their zone, which covers a tremendous variation of kind of higher, drier desert into their waterways. And again, what was important in terms of health and health professionals is their very core concept of going back to traditional law, what they call their original instructions, because that's how they are going to protect their resources, their cultural resources, their land resources, their water resources, and protecting the foods, which what they and those what that community calls their men's food and women's food, which have something to do with, again, the animals as opposed to the roots and berries, which are the women's foods. And what they're working on there is that apparently they don't really like the USDA's food pyramid. They said, who's eating a pyramid? We're not eating pyramid, but we eat landscapes. And so we're working on eating a landscape, and we're working to protect that landscape. And so what they're trying to do with their Department of Ecology is to train the health professionals to say, you need to really rethink that, because this is what this is what our community needs, and this is cross-cutting. And you may need to rethink that pyramid and to be working with us in terms of examples that are really specific for our landscape, and to be able to help the community to understand that we need their support to be able to make this a reality for us to protect these places. There's been some interesting as I think about this access to traditional foods. There has been an interesting consortium in Puget Sound, which essentially is the inland waterway in between the land and going out to the Pacific Ocean, kind of near the Seattle area. And so several tribes, both Tulalip and Muckleshoot, have done a bit of an arrangement with the local county as well as the Burke Museum in Seattle. And what they're working on is using some research that I'll tell you about in a moment to actually look at the therapeutic value of traditional food diets. Could this prevent diabetes? Could this treat diabetes? And they have an interesting way of thinking about it. It's not just health professionals. They actually, a good part of that group is actually elders within the tribe that have stepped forward to be involved in this with archaeologists. I mean, when was the last time any of you worked with an archaeologist? It's kind of fascinating what they're doing. And one of the things that they have actually published was work that was done, again, with tribal consent to actually look at middens. And middens are basically the refuse pile, I guess you could say, within a region. And what they were really curious about was that what was in those middens? What did people actually eat in pre-contact times? And they found out that people ate quite a few things. And they're using this work to inform what they're doing now as what I guess you could call it translational research in terms of what can we do today practically within our diabetes programs and health centers to promote traditional foods within the community. And so when you think about this, think of what you just ate in the last month in terms of, if you're an adult, if you do eat meat or fish, how many types of animals gave their life for you? And for many of us, it might just be a few. I could ask the same thing in terms of, you know, what's your plant intake like? And so we have found through this combination of some Western science and informed by indigenous knowledge of the communities that there was tremendous variety, far more than what we see here, and that some of those resources still exist and, again, need to be protected. Accessing traditional foods, some of the tribes are very interested, again, in just in the political component of this because, again, it's a treaty right. Certainly in Western Washington with the Treaty of 1855. So there are the communities are really interested in preserving their hunting rights, their fishing rights, and their rights to gather. And there are actually some combinations of consortia involving places related to the feds, for example, the Bureau of Land Management, state-related areas, tribal entities, including health clinics that are actually have had several conferences related to how are we going to get better access to some of the areas for protection. And this also links to urban communities, because again, the urban communities have been somewhat left out of this, although they may have traditional territories in the very same zone, but without the legal protection. Duwamish is one example. And there was, again, just a recent conference just last month related strictly to this issue of accessing and preserving traditional foods in Seattle. That was standing room only. I was completely amazed at the work that's being done around our region. Oh, by the way, that's a picture of one of our former chief residents in Seattle in pediatrics. And just even our health professionals, who especially our indigenous health professionals, when they're training, they need to be grounded. They need a place to go. And that place to go isn't necessarily home or the gym. They need to get out. And so she was so happy when we said, we're going up to Huckleberry Camp. She couldn't get her tent packed fast enough to come on up with us. So that's a happy person. Again, how do we keep our health professionals happy? How do we keep our indigenous professionals connected? And the interesting thing about that young woman is that just with her responsibility as a chief resident in a regional referral center for children, she was coming in contact with a lot of families, particularly from Montana and Alaska, who would ask her for help with getting food that was appropriate for them because they were not familiar with what was being served within the context of Seattle Children's Hospital. And she was very diligent about this in terms of trying to find people in the community who could help her link to food resources to help these very sick children and also help their families who were suffering within these hospitals. The tribal colleges, Western Washington State just has Northwest Indian College, and which is fantastic. They have done some really interesting work that I've been involved with their traditional plants for diabetes prevention. They have a very small work group with this, but what they've been doing, and this project actually technically just finished and has morphed into another, so this has been work that they've been doing over the past 4 or 5 years. They've had monthly meetings in tribal communities that offer to be the hosts and who actually decide who their speakers are, what the community wants to share. It has nothing to do with what the academic center wants them to share. And what has been very clear is that what the community wants done is, again, protection of the knowledge, but also sharing the knowledge with people who have the heart to do this work. And so they have actually extended consistently invitations for people working with anywhere within Indian health systems to come and join them. And I think if there's any sadness with this successful program is that very few health providers show up. And the only reason I know that is because they'll come to me as someone involved in both of these ways and say, you know, we wish we could get our docs to do this. We wish we could get our nurse practitioners to do this or to come listen. You know, that's really what we want. We don't necessarily want them to do what you're doing, Terry. We just want them to listen to us. And it's actually quite a lot of fun. The workshops vary based on how the community puts them together, but they always involve some degree of hands-on work, which again is our traditional way of teaching. It has nothing to do with a piece of paper or a book or a website. It has to do with a live human being who has a relationship to these plants and has this knowledge and is offering the gift of their time for you, and that's what we do. That's what's being done. And this month is seaweeds, which I know nothing about. So, this is just again examples of some of the harvesting. Actually, this woman is actually harvesting camas bulbs, blue camas, which is a traditional food in the drier sections of eastern Washington. But one of the texts that I found useful for some of our clinicians is one that Northwest Indian College helped to publish, which is very practical. And again, that's what my patients are wanting too when they're asking about these ways of going back to their roots, so to speak, is literally, Terry, I don't remember a lot of that, or I was never taught that. But I'm interested in treating myself with some of these ways, and I need some help or reminders sometimes. And they've created a beautiful book to that's very unique to the plants of our region, but it's very, very well done. It has been very well accepted within the tribal communities. They're moving into a different project now, talking about access of traditional foods for tribal cooks, since there are many feasts and gatherings. And again, I guess it's the movement away from fry bread is really what I'm talking about. So, some of the cooks, they would like to learn about some of these foods, but they may not have actually gathered them or be consistently using them. So that's what that's their current direction. We see access to plant medicine in our area with even in treatment centers, and the Northwest Indian Treatment Center, which is run by Squaxin Island, has a unique program that they've presented on many times and that I've toured, which is really terrific. And they have combined both plant medicine as well as food within their garden. Now, this is a garden that's actually cared for by the clients. That's nice. And that's part of their treatment. And it's also an option for them because they are eating from the garden. They are literally eating the seasons of that garden as that garden becomes available. But within the context of the curriculum, the cultural curriculum, they're also talking about how to provide people with safer alternatives to deal with the issues that they're dealing with. And of course, they're dealing with some pretty serious issues in terms of addictions treatment or underlying PTSD or so many things. But the clients have consistently reported their tremendous empowerment with this for the reconnection that it allows them to have to help heal from the issues that they're facing. The small clinic that I work at in Snoqualmie also has a medicinal garden. It's a tiny one that's actually, and what's interesting here is that it's actually on the clinic site. It's in our backyard. So I know many of you have garden projects, and we see a lot of those in our area too, but we see very few that are actually linked to a specific Western system, if you will. And the community, this was community driven. Their elders wanted this and actually went after a grant to get it. But they had the money and were at a crossroads in terms of how they wanted to proceed. But what I found with this very small garden is that it has worked to promote discussion of traditional medicine with my patients. And that was, I think the other clinicians feel the same way, that it allows just a slow building of trust. But it also is very pragmatic, because in some cases it allows dispensing, because I do make medicine from that garden. And again, just with the way that the tribe has set this up, this is considered within the spectrum of services that we are able to offer, and so it's not that it goes through USP, formularies related to this. There's no chart. We operate on traditional principles here, and so if someone needs the medicine and if I have that available, I must give that to you. That's what I was taught. That's why those plants survive in our teaching, is that we have to give that away. So there's no copays, there's none of this. And so, but there is, again, traditional teaching of this in terms of how you use this medicine. What we've also found is that this, again, as I mentioned, the tribe is very small, and so we have healers visiting from different areas to be able to provide perhaps one-on-one healing services for people. And sometimes one of the healers in particular from Canada has a way of thinking about this, that if a client comes to him, that client may be prescribed medicine that they actually have to go gather. And some of our people have just not been trained in terms of identification of what that is, or knowing where they can go get that plant. And so the healer will tell them, well, why don't you go to Terry, go look at the garden. Terry will show you what it looks like. So my part of my job is to tell them where they can go get that medicine and what that, make sure that they understand how to collect that safely, because that's not my role. That's part of their healing. They have to do the work themselves. And we have kids who help. You know, our young people are really helpful. And again, just we're trying to, you know, we are trying to use this tiny little garden tool to be able to work with some of the health professions pipeline training in our area that's linked to University of Washington. You know, these are, many of them are young people who are in high school, who are from a variety of different urban and tribal communities, and they want to be of service. And this is where the community is grateful for their service, you know, to help maintain this garden. There are other gardens, and I won't go into the details of that, other than to say, again, that our communities are deciding what's important to them. So, for example, Nisqually has chosen a lot of plants related to basketry, since that was a really vital piece of their culture. In terms of other cultural resource preservation, I just want to point out that, again, some of the knowledge that could be known perhaps should not be known. And some communities have been very cautious with that in terms of offering classes, but offering classes that are somewhat restricted so that they want to know who's in the class before they're going to provide any kind of materials or written materials. And so it's not this isn't something that you can buy in the store. You may be able to access some of these resources, but you have to actually be there so you understand the context and that the community can protect what it needs to protect. We're shifting gears to our access to our elders as mentors. And some of you from Seattle or who have ever lived in Seattle or have ever worked at Seattle Indian Health Board will probably recognize Grandma Helen Sage, who's a beautiful grandmother who is well known to our community. This access is not just for our students, but it's also for those of us who are in the field. And I am reminded about a quote that I heard an elder from Alaska talk about, Peter Jacob, who's a Yupik man, who said in a large conference that I'll share with you in a moment, you know, don't leave your elders behind. Because as we were looking around the room at that conference, they had, again, their cultural teaching had set it up in such a way that there were many elders in that room in a medical meeting, because that was their job, was to support the people and to be able to also educate health professionals. And so I have not forgotten those words, and we see some examples of what he was trying to teach. And actually, Peter Jacob worked in Alaska, so I'll digress and go a little farther in the Pacific Northwest for a moment. And some of you may be familiar with the University of Alaska has several campuses, one of which is in Fairbanks. And their behavioral health program is very specific about having Indigenous elders on faculty. This is not a diploma. You don't need a certificate that you had an associate's or a bachelor's. You are who you are. You are someone who carries Indigenous knowledge and is respected. Those elders are in the classroom. They're in the classroom in Fairbanks. They're in the classroom in the various campuses. They are online with teleconferencing. The elders have learned how to do this and are supporting the people in the field with students who are unable to come to Fairbanks. But they also, these elders also travel with the other, what I call the diploma faculty. So when they go out of the region, the elders come with them. So, in fact, the elders, I think, are chaperoning the other faculty there. But I think that's so important in terms of teaching about, again, who knows better about these very sensitive areas of mental health and culture, you know, related to healing our people, but the elders there. So they have a terrific example. The meeting that I was referring to that Peter Jacobs was involved in is Pathways into Health. And I mentioned that not because it's Northwest specific, although they've had several of their meetings in Alaska and Montana in recent years, but more that this consortium is trying to build an interdisciplinary way of sharing what's working for us to keep our pipeline going from everything from how do we get entry-level health professionals involved, people involved in medical records, people involved in lab, people involved in X-ray technology, how do we get people into healthcare management in our communities, how do we get them through, you know, into nursing school, how do we get them to be pharmacists and beyond. And one of their core issues is how do we do this in a culturally appropriate way in terms of training them in certain areas of traditional medicine that's appropriate for them. And so this group is still struggling with that, but that's one of their core concepts. We see other, traditional healers being willing to work with our young trainees at University of Washington. At the medical school, we serve a five-state area with what we call WAMI, which is Washington, Wyoming, Alaska, Idaho, and Montana. And since 1992, when Dr. Walt Hollow, who some of you may know, founded the Indian Health Pathway Program, it's essentially a curriculum at the medical school that is trying to promote our graduates, both native and non-native, to be able to serve our communities. And one of the core clerkships that they need to do is specifically on traditional medicine. Now, this doesn't make them a traditional healer. That's not what I'm saying. These are communities that were specifically chosen because they had indigenous MDs or non-indigenous MDs who were very well accepted in the community, who were willing to work in partnership with indigenous healers, the tribal healers, who were willing to work with them and to show them what they thought was appropriate. So again, the community is deciding what it's going to share with these people. And what our track record is showing is that many of those graduates have indeed gone on to serve our communities in urban or reservation settings. This one's still in our region with the University of British Columbia. The family medicine residency at Victoria has a really interesting way of talking, again, in primary care settings, and family medicine in particular, teaching clinicians on how to work their soap format. We all know soap. We all write soap notes. But most of us don't put down spiritual or cultural factors in our soap note or ask about it. And so their faculty is really working hard to work with interns and residents to get them to think about that. Now, again, for, you know, if someone has a strep throat, you're probably not going to be, you know, going along those lines, you know, in an acute care setting. But for a large number of the diagnoses that we see, they are trained in terms of being able to diplomatically and appropriately bring up these issues in terms of what can we do to support you in this. You know, given whatever that diagnosis may be, whatever those needs may be. So it's something that I was really glad when they, were sharing that, because I think that those are important concepts that we need to be able to work with our trainees on. There are examples of on-the-job mentoring. I know many of you also do this in your areas. Puyallup Tribal Health Authority is in the Tacoma area in Washington. They have required orientation related to traditional medicine there. And it's also a part of their performance evaluation. So they're putting their money where their mouth is. They want to make sure that their clinicians, and essentially all staff, it isn't just their healthcare providers, have some competency in terms of what the tribe wants them to know. And they also have ongoing staff quarterly in-services that are consistent. It's built into their cycle of their year that relate to traditional medicine topics with different visiting healers that come to the clinic. And this is mandatory. You must come, just like you need to show up for whatever your shift is. Everyone in the clinic is there who's employed by the community. There are other examples of this. Seattle Indian Health Board has a traditional health liaison, and what I think is interesting here is that especially our urban clinics struggle a bit in terms of this issues of credentialing and issues of the real issue of legitimacy with our traditional healers in terms of making sure that it's someone who's accepted by the community. And so SIHB has actually gone to the extra step of having to create its own credentialing, if you will, so in order to bring healers into an urban setting and allow the various funding agencies that we have to deal with to be able to keep the service available to our patients. That's a little different than what the capabilities of what a tribe can do. So the urbans do struggle with this, but we've met, and actually there are kind of JCO type reviews going on as I speak, so I hope that will all go well. They've also offered monthly, what they call intercultural gatherings for the healthcare community. It isn't just the clinic. It's anyone, in our region. So we have people from the major trauma center at Harborview who attend. We have people from Children's Hospital in Seattle. And actually what's been pretty fun is that we also have folks from Bastyr, which is the naturopathic college in the area, coming to learn from the elders who have chosen to share there. So and the best year, it's been a good relationship. The other thing that we're seeing there are some work related to preserving our traditional medicines related to traditional tobacco and just using the cultural tool of having powwows in the urban community, but having teachings available and actual plant medicine available for people that is traditional tobacco as a way of kind of counteracting the impact of commercial tobacco. Montana has a terrific example of mentoring as well, and those of you who are here, I'd love to hear how that's going right now with what's called the Advocates Program. And this is something I wish I had when I had my first job in Rosebud, because I was less familiar with the culture there, and I wish that I'd had someone had a program that essentially paired me with an elder, which is what this program does. When a new staff member is hired, someone who's a clinician, so again, it could be, right now it sounds like they're focusing on mid-levels and physicians right now as their starting point. But this is really community-driven, and they ask a new hire to be paired with an elder in the community. And that person has been chosen for their respect within the community, and their job is to build relationship with that one person. So for that clinician who again, may not be from Montana and may not be familiar with the culture of Crow, that's the elder's job, is to help help them orient in an appropriate way. So they're not just being given a booklet or watching a DVD. It's actually relationship, which is a core teaching. And it allows the clinicians to actually ask questions that might be kind of awkward to ask, or that might come up with their colleagues, for example. Again, just knowing what the appropriate processes are for birth. Are there certain things that need to, if you're doing births within a hospital setting, are there certain things I should know culturally? How does that work with end-of-life issues, et cetera? And so sometimes these elders actually serve to be the sounding board for them, in addition to inviting them to different cultural gatherings, which we heard our previous speaker talk about how important that was. I'm shifting gears to what I think of as just one of the important gatherings that's been happening in our area for about the last 20 years, which is called the Canoe Journey. And some of you may have actually been a part of Canoe Journey in terms of being part of the host communities or being on the beach when the canoes come or the canoes go. This is a gathering that's been going on for about 22 years. There were a few years where they didn't have consistent journeys. But there are well over 10,000 people who come for this. It's a cultural renaissance, if you will, especially for the Western Washington or the Lushoot Tsleil speaking communities to bring culture back, bring healing back to the communities. And it crosses the border, since the border is artificial and also something that severs our communities. And what is happening is for the communities, the tribes who choose to participate in this, they may have one or more what are called canoe families. And these may literally be blood-related families, but may not be, that gather together to be able to prepare to go on what will be ultimately a three-week journey from wherever they live to wherever the host community is. And this is all by water. So some of our communities have to travel through rivers in order to get to the salt water. This has been building over the course of the last two decades. Every community decides a bit differently how it wants to hit, what its priorities are. But what seems very consistent is that they're doing this for their youth. They're doing this so that their children will be able to hear the language again, hear those songs again, learn the dances, and learn the protocol that is appropriate to greet another tribe, to ask permission to be on their land, and to be able to learn the skill set and the physical endurance of how do you prepare your body and your mind to do this kind of work. What do you eat? What don't you eat? Maintaining sobriety is a core tenet for anyone who's on canoe journey. There can be no drugs or alcohol related to this. Our communities are doing a lot of work in this area in terms of building to be able to participate in canoe journey. It's the power of community. It goes beyond, again, what can we do on a one-to-one setting with individuals? This really goes to what can we do to heal our communities. The community's doing it for itself. And there is a role with, there are a variety of ceremonies that occur within the context of this. And when the community finally ends at the final host nation, it is open to everyone. There is a role for medical support with this. And we've seen our healthcare teams be involved related to everything from, again, preparing traditional first aid kits, i.e. a Western-based kit, to actually helping the communities work with herbal first aid, physical body work therapies, because, again, many people really want to stay as drug-free as possible during this, and also being able to travel as clinician helpers. So if a community asks you to join them on the canoe, it's a great honor. And I think that was one of my happiest days when I got to be on the as one of the pullers for Snoqualmie with mostly young kids that were less than 18 years old. So my life is in their hands, literally. We're all together in this boat. I think Connie McLeod said it best. It's situations like this, these intercultural healings that lift us up, and it's all about the spirit. The interesting sidebar to the canoe journey that I just learned about is through this Coast Salish gathering, which is really more of a policy connection with tribal leaders on the U.S. side of the border and tribal leaders in Canada. And they're, again, these things are all linked. They're very concerned about the health of the water and health of land, and they're worried about access to traditional foods, especially seafood. And so they're still planning a potential Western science-related project to actually do monitoring samples along the entire route of the canoe journey, which is a really interesting concept when you think about it, because again, you've got the U.S., EPA, and how many water samples do they take? I really don't know. And then you've got the Canadian equivalent, but then you've got maybe, 100 or more canoes that are traveling along indigenous territories in terms of sampling along what's going on in our tribes. And actually being able to use that data to support the work on either side of the border, I think, is really it's a brilliant indigenous and Western combined project. So I wish them well with that. We heard about stories earlier. There are a couple of projects in Oregon that are going on. Some of you may be familiar with that. In terms of, again, of just preserving oral tradition as part of our medicine. And there's actually a Storytellers Association, which I think is really terrific also, that has an annual meeting. And they are very frequent speakers to healthcare conferences. They get invited all the time to share stories. Because those stories, they want us to know as health professionals, especially if we're not originally from those areas, because some of those stories are healing and are familiar to people in the community in terms of reminding them about our core values. There's a new project that is going on related to this Wisdom of the Elders, which is focusing on some of the tougher areas that we have to deal with domestic violence, addictions, diabetes. And again, they're using contemporary modes of storytelling, which go beyond digital storytelling. And so we're pretty excited about that. This mentoring has to happen with our young people too. And there's a very small project that University of Washington's working on just with urban youth who, again, can be more disenfranchised on many levels. And what they're trying to do is to give them, empower them using digital stories and other techniques to actually interview elders, different traditional healers, other people in the community with the focus, again, on either medicines or food. And that project will be finishing up sometime later this year, and those stories will be available on their website. Right now, they just have a few stories from last year that are there. I won't go into this too much other than to overstate the obvious that, for traditional medicine to survive, our language has to survive, and our region is in a bit of trouble with this. Just this past weekend, I missed this, but they had a gathering that they call Lifting the Language, and as a consortium to be able to promote Lushootseat in our area, which at least the tribe I work for has a consistent language class that has always been open to healthcare professionals. That's not at the tribal college or a community college. It is just in the community, and they kind of want you to be there. So how do we do this? How do we make this space for our culture, for this traditional medicine in the context of our health settings? And I think I can't tell you what to do. Again, as I said before, this is really just to put out some ideas about what's happening in our region, not because this is the best way or the way, but just to stimulate what resources you may have in your area with what and see if there's any commonality. I think the important thing, again, especially with my students, is that we really have to broaden our idea of what health is, and again, not in the four walls of our clinics. And I also want them to kind of buff up their SOAP assessments too, though. So we got to show up. We have to show up at community events. We have to show up, you know, and be creative with that. And again, and when the community asks us to do something, we need to be there for that. Learning more about what's going on in terms of culture in the area is important. But again, the twist for me, again, is this issue of environmental health and what goes on with traditional food resources. So if that's not happening in your area, I'm just asking you to think about what's going on with that, as well as, again, just whatever your resources are related to plant medicine. I know some of you struggle with the issue of finding healers in your area, but those people do exist. Our elders can travel, those who are in good enough health to do that. And just Peter Jacob's words still rang, you know, where are your elders? Where are they in the context of the decisions we make as committees? Again, I had to bring elders into the classroom at University of Washington. Boy, that took a lot of work just in terms of tweaking the protocols within an academic center. But I felt it was really important for students to be exposed to that. And again, connecting to your tribal college if you happen to have one that's in your area. I think we need to support those who are doing the work of cultural and natural resources. Again, I see the health impact when people speak privately, you know, in clinic about how hard it is in terms of the struggles that they face. Even within some of our tribes are not as balanced as we might want them to be, and there can be internal struggles. And so it's really important for those of us to be able to hold that energy for them while they're doing the work, you know, at home. They know how to do this best, and all we can do is support. But I also wonder about what we, you know, some of these, again, our traditional foods, and what do we serve, you know, at our potlucks? I'm always pretty interested in looking at the potluck table. And I'm really careful about that in terms of what I choose to bring to potlucks, because, again, I think that's really that's an honor to bring that food. And if we have the gifts of food that we've grown that's from our old seeds or gathered, I think that's really vital. I also think it's important that we as clinicians think about how we're going to reinforce traditional medicine concepts that you may have learned in some other arena, because all of you had a life before you went into healthcare. And so whether that's this concept of, again, eating the landscape or these issues of storytelling, I just ask you to think about that. Perhaps, again, your in-services may need a little bit of adjustment. You know, but maybe not. Maybe you're doing a good job with that. But I wonder what the input is. How do you even give input to the community you work for that you might want something like this? Could the community do that, but they're not getting clear direction from you that this is something that is important? And just, again, just thinking about what our resources are that are just not in what I consider the typical medical box. We need to go back there. Returning to our roots, because it improves outcomes for our communities. And again, I can only speak for myself, but if I didn't do that work with land, these other things, I couldn't be in this line of work for 25 years. I don't think I could have done it. I have to be able to keep that same teaching, even though I work for a tribe that's different than my own. And I'm grateful to those communities who have similar worldviews and who understand that these ways of being need to continue on. But we really need to get out there, get it out of our offices. And again, I think Isidore Tom had something to share. He's an elder from the Tulalip tribes, you know, talking with some of my health profession students in a class. And he just looked at them and, you know, said, "Oh, you're so young." But, you know, I hope we can get this connection going, you know, as, you know, you on this academic side and us here, because I think together we can really save lives. And I think Mr. Tom is right. So I hope you'll just give a little thought to what approaches you might take to support what the community wants out of you, rather than necessarily you have gifts, but let the community figure out what those gifts are and be ready to accept the call when they ask you to step forward, because that's a hard thing to do sometimes too. So with that, I'll finish and say, Mwashwakombo Dawaji, now thank you for inviting me.